Peter Johnson introducing the Catholic Heritage Program broadcasting from England, bringing you traditions, trips, and information from our Catholic past and inspiration for our Catholic future. In the 19th century, there were big developments in the life of the Catholic Church in England. The full significance of this is only now just being fully understood. It is a story from which we can learn much and gain courage and hope. Author Madeline Beard has been talking to Joanna Bogle about it.
But it is so deep an affliction to my dear father and mother, so great a breaking up of our family, so painful a loss at Althorp, where his presence and ministry, though but imperfect pleasures, were yet invaluable pleasures to us, that it weighs us all down. He took this step suddenly, and with very insufficient forethought and knowledge, altogether a bad business.
That was Lady Lyttelton, lady-in-waiting to Queen Victoria, writing about her brother, George Spencer, who had become a Catholic and was planning to become a Catholic priest. And reading that letter aloud was Madeline Beard, whose book, Faith and Fortune, explores the lives and message of some of those 19th century converts to the Catholic faith. So, Madeline, this was an unusual choice of subject for a book to write now, at the beginning of the 21st century. Why did you choose to write about a relatively obscure subject?
In 1989, I had published a book by Routledge called English Landed Society in the 20th Century. When this was published, people asked me what I was going to do next, and I said I'd like to write something about the spiritual lives of the landed aristocracy. Everyone said that will be a very slim volume. Nonetheless, I kept plugging away at this idea, thinking perhaps I could write about country house chapels, anything that was to do with the spiritual nature of the many large landowners in this country, who had dominated the country with their wealth throughout the 19th century. One day, I was in the university library in Cambridge, where I had done the research for my book on the 20th century landed aristocracy, and I saw a book called simply Converts to Rome. Someone else had requested it. I took it out myself and looked through. It was, in fact, an alphabetical list of everyone of note who had become Catholics from about 1850 to 1910, and this volume had been updated through the early years of the 20th century. I saw one name, the Honourable Charles Pakenham. I discovered his biography and discovered that when he had died, they had moved his grave and discovered that his body was incorrupt. I then realized that there was an astonishing story to tell of the aristocratic English men and women who had become Catholics, many of whom had led very, very holy lives.
So it really is a little bit of undiscovered English history. I want to hear about Pakenham, who you've obviously, that's an unknown story, not one I'd ever heard about, even though I grew up in England as a Catholic. And I know about some of the famous converts, like John Henry Newman and Father William Faber. But before we get on to them, tell me about the one that we began with, that's Lord Spencer, George Spencer, whose story has a funny link with modern life.
It's an astonishing link that at the funeral of the late Princess of Wales in September, very, very few people knew of her astonishing ancestor, the Honourable George Spencer, who was actually born in Admiralty House, past which the funeral cortege of the Princess of Wales had gone past. He was born within the last weeks of the 18th century. He went to Eton, like so many of his contemporaries, and while he was at Eton, he was actually taken away to be given a governess back at home who was evangelical in her approach. It's very interesting that in the story of this book, it's so often particular individuals meeting other particular individuals at a particular state of their lives, which can have a much greater influence later on. And George Spencer then went to Trinity College, Cambridge, like so many others. And later on, as the second son of Lord Spencer, he entered the Church of England, became the vicar of Great Brinkton in Northamptonshire, where, again, going back to the Princess of Wales, she was taken in her funeral cortege right back to Althorp in Northamptonshire. And when he was in Paris in 1830 or thereabouts, he actually went to the opera and was seeing Don Giovanni, and at the end of Don Giovanni had this extraordinary religious conversion and realized that his life was almost as bad as Don Giovanni. He became very interested in becoming much more devout in his Church of England ministry. It was by an extraordinary succession again of almost, one would say providential encounters with other people, that he came across another undergraduate at Trinity, the young Ambrose Phillips de Nile, who invited him to a house party in Leicestershire. And during the course of that weekend, he met other people who were very interested in the state of the Church of England at that time. And through the sheer force of the argument of the young Ambrose Phillips de Lisle, Spencer, himself very devout, was received into the church in the Dominican church in Leicester by a Belgian priest.
And then he had to tell his family, with the results that we've heard, and given his connections, this caused an immense stir. His sister, who was married to Lord Lyttelton, was a lady-in-waiting to Queen Victoria. I mean, in those days, to become a Catholic, and especially to consider becoming a Catholic priest, was just regarded as social death.
Yes, in 1829, it was only then that the Emancipation Act had been passed. So in 1830, to become a Catholic was an extraordinary thing. And this was 15 years before the Oxford Movement, as it's known, when so many well-known people did become Catholics. So it was a very early example of a very extraordinary thing to do. And of course, the English aristocracy had inherited a great, as so many people had, a great prejudice against Catholicism. The whole story of prejudice, the terrible stories of priests, have been passed on from generation to generation, that the Mass was an awful superstition, that anyone who should dare to wear a habit as he did, he joined a very austere order of Italian priests called the Passionists, which, extraordinarily enough, had been founded at the end of the 18th century specifically to pray for the conversion of England. It was founded by St. Paul of the Cross in Lombardy. He joined that order, and of course the other famous priest of that order who came over to England was Dominic Barbary, who knew Spencer and who greatly revered him. Barbary then, of course, received Newman into the church. Very few people people were amazed that even Newman had heard of the Passionists, a very obscure order who had made their way across to England, and it was really an extraordinary thing that Newman should have been brought into the church by him.
And what about Spencer's life? He became a Passionist and a preacher and so on, but he didn't succeed in converting his older brother or members of his family and down the generations, well, right through to Diana Spencer, who became Princess of Wales. They remained Anglican and do to this day.
Yes, in the face of it, he didn't actually have a great impact on his family. Nonetheless, he devoted his life to praying and preaching. He led such an austere existence. He was jeered at. He wandered the streets and the lanes of industrial England. He died in a ditch. He led a very, very penitential existence. His entire mission was dedicated to Christian unity, which again was an extraordinary thing to talk about in those days. So, in fact, he didn't have a direct influence on his family, although he did everything he could to nurture all the connections he had. He went along to Downing Street and asked to speak to the Prime Minister. He was dressed in his Passionist robes. He was turned away. He said, "I am the brother of Lord Spencer," and he was taken in. But all these conversations didn't lead anywhere. Nonetheless, he used every single connection he could to try and further the faith among his contemporaries and among his peers.
And he did bring a number of people into the church in the course of his ordinary preaching ministry, didn't he? Because he was working in all those mission chapels, and he worked with the poor, heard thousands of confessions, brought many people in, and so on, among the industrial poor.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Among the numerous souls were brought into the church by his ministry, because he led such an exemplary existence. And physically, he did actually look a bit like, he's a Spencer, and when we think of Winston Spencer Churchill, if you look at his photograph, he does actually look a bit like Churchill, and he had that same vigour, that same astonishing passion to one ideal amidst the face of extraordinary odds. And although his life might look as if it hadn't actually achieved very much, in actual fact, the seeds he planted bore extraordinary fruits in this country.
And he was really a precursor of that immense wave of converts which was to come later, some of whom you've mentioned in your book. Tell us about this chap, Pakenham. That's another very aristocratic name, the Longford family. Wasn't he a young officer?
Yes, he was a guards officer. And again, it shows the mysterious nature of being brought into the faith. It was a particular person who gave him a religious medal. Somebody else gave him a copy of Newman's sermons. Somebody else gave him a breviary to read. It was the extraordinary nature of divine grace working through particular people that led Pakenham to become a Catholic, to renounce his inheritance. His uncle had actually made him the heir to his estates in Worcestershire, and he had to tell his uncle that he was actually going to become a priest. And he joined the Passionists and didn't live for very long, and lived a very austere life. But you could see just through that in one individual having an extraordinary effect, again, on all his contemporaries. He had very well-known, highly regarded names, non-Catholics, coming to visit him in his little cell. And some of them thought that he had, you know, they noticed this astonishing transformation in someone who was already very virtuous, but was leading another life away from the barracks in which he had done his training, but nonetheless using all that discipline of his earlier existence to devote to the Catholic Church.
Now, tell us something about some of the ladies who converted. Some were married, and a lot of them had a very strong social conscience, didn't they? And some became nuns. So let's hear about some of these women.
There are a number of orders which were founded in the 19th century specifically to help with all the terrible social problems that there were at that time. And so many of these people who had led devout lives outside the church entered their religious life and did a great deal to help with all the problems that that needed to be dealt with in that time. I'm thinking also of someone who didn't actually become a nun, but who did a great deal to help with her charitable works, and that is Lady Georgiana Fullerton, who was a best-selling novelist and used her novels, the money she made from the novels, to finance her work for the poor. So I think it might be quite interesting to talk about her.
Well, certainly it does for me, because you and I are both writers, and so I didn't ever know about her. Are her novels still available? Does one hear about them these days?
I think one doesn't, but...
They're a bit out of fashion.
Nonetheless, they were extremely popular at the time. She was a granddaughter, actually, of the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire. And interestingly enough, when she lived in the where she was brought up, she used to see, looking out of her window, men, women and children going to Mass on Sundays, and were told they are the Roman Catholics going to their church. And then she heard Mass for the first time at Slindon House in Sussex, staying with the Newburgh family, where she said there was something in the sight of a Catholic rural congregation which made a strange impression on me. She married a diplomat. She married someone called Alexander Fullerton, who actually did a great deal to help found the Brompton Oratory. Another aspect we'll probably talk about later are the number of wonderful churches that were founded by these converts, hence the title of my book, Faith and Fortune, How You Can Use Your Fortune to Further the Church. Alexander Fullerton became interested in helping out when she was a diplomat's wife, helping out with the poor in Paris, and then in her widowhood, her bereavement moved her to dedicate the rest of her life to charitable works, feeling a particular affinity with the poor Irish in London, whose religion she shared. Another aspect of English Catholicism is the fact that so many Irish people came over to this country in the wake of the famine, and you had the extraordinary combination of very well-placed, aristocratic, wealthy men and women who shared their faith and who helped the poor, impoverished Irish, particularly in London and the large cities.
I'm fascinated by this because we owe a lot of our wonderful 19th century Catholic churches to that mixture. They were sometimes built for a massive Irish population, many of whom also contributed incredibly generously with their small means. Mm-hmm. And then you had these churches that were financed by the very rich people, and together they formed a network of parish churches that simply had not existed 50 years earlier.
No, in fact, my book is actually divided into two parts, because a lot of people didn't actually have the opportunity to go into a Catholic church in this country in which they could see the liturgy celebrated as it was throughout the rest of Europe. And one thinks in particular of the Brompton Oratory, which really was a Roman Catholic church. I think also this term Roman Catholic was actually used as a term of derision. We are Catholics. These are English Catholics. they aren't Italian or Roman, they are English Catholics. And nonetheless, the Italian nature of Catholicism was brought over to great effect in this country with these extraordinary churches that were built. Often in towns and cities, they would start off with a school. Once you had started a school, then you would gather a congregation, a community, converts were made, and then a church was built. But if you go to Cambridge, for example, the only spire you see in Cambridge, which, unlike Oxford, which is known as the City of Spires, the only spire which you can see really for miles around is that of the Church of Our Lady and the English Martyrs.
The Catholic Church?
Yes.
Yes, and that was built towards the end of the 19th century.
Yes, that was built 100 years ago. And again, this was new money being brought into a very old church, which had been brought over to this country by Pope St. Gregory in 597. So in the past, when people talked about the conversion of England, they were really talking about the reconversion of England. England had already been converted, and it had departed from the faith in the dissolution of monasteries and the Reformation of the early 16th century.
And so this 19th century reconversion, with this extraordinary mixture of well-to-do, often aristocratic people, poorer Irish people, and then the converts, many of whom were also very poor. They were ordinary country people who would have heard Father Ignatius Spencer preach, or who would have been helped by Lady Georgiana Fullerton, let's mm-hmm. say, and would have become Catholics.
Yes.
And they needed churches, and so that's mm-hmm. how they got built.
Yes. So there are particular villages in Leicestershire, for example, where another Italian priest, Father Rosmini, came over with another Italian order, the Institute of Charity. There are particular villages in Leicestershire which are entirely Catholic, thanks precisely to the influence of a particular Italian priest at that particular time.
One of the things that's interesting, of course, was that during these middle years of the 19th century, the Church of England wasn't really concerned with the poor, was it? You'd had the Wesleyan Revival, which gave us the Methodist chapels, but the Church of England was rather neglectful of large numbers of ordinary folk in Britain, really.
Yes, in fact, I think an interesting parallel today, actually, is when you talk about a relatively small number of converts to the church in this country. Nonetheless, the things that they are struck by is that when they go into a Catholic church, it encompasses such a huge variety of people. If you go into Westminster Cathedral, you really are aware this is the universal church. The Church of England now and then was really associated with a particular strata of society. The Catholic Church, being the universal church, was really embracing everyone.
And so to today, in the last decade, particularly since the decision of the Anglican Church in 1992 in England to ordain priestesses, we've seen another wave of converts. Do you see a parallel between this wave of converts and the ones you've been writing about in the 19th century?
Not to the same extent. It was interesting that on the votes in November 1992, I did actually begin to write set about writing this book. It was just a coincidence that that had happened. In 1993, Catholics in this country were astonished by a number of interesting converts, well-known people who did all become Catholics in the first few months. In January of that year, the Duchess of Kent, the cousin of the Queen, became a Catholic. She'd had long devotion to Walsingham, the great national shrine where a lot of Anglo-Catholics used to go on pilgrimage, and she very discreetly was received into the church by Cardinal Hume at Westminster Cathedral, and that historically was quite an important moment in this country. Then, a couple of months later, the editor of the Daily Telegraph, Charles Moore, became a Catholic, and for you and I it was astonishing to hear him privately discuss his thoughts about becoming a Catholic to a group of Catholic writers. The word never got out, and I do remember going to the Westminster Cathedral clergy house to deliver a letter, opening the door in February of that year and seeing Charles Moore come out. And that was very dramatic, knowing that this was a very well-known person in this country who did become a Catholic, and he wrote about his conversion as well.
Yes, I remember that, because he gave us this informal talk as editor of the Daily Telegraph. We invited him to talk to the Catholic Writers Guild, and I remember that we rather teased him afterwards and said his talk was "Why I Am Not Yet a Catholic," because it was very obvious where his inclinations were lying. And because of our tradition in the Catholic Writers Guild that you can speak freely and nobody's going to blab, none of us did. And the story certainly didn't get out. We all kept quiet about what he had said, even though we were rather impressed with him. I remember it being rather powerful and amusing and moving. Yes. His talk was very, very good. But none of us talked about it. And then, as you say, he was able to convert in his own time. And when he did, front page of the Daily Telegraph, "Why I Am Becoming a Catholic." Yes, yes. Yes, I remember that.
And certainly in the Telegraph, one can see a certain Catholic influence of all the major national newspapers. I think Catholics are more likely to read the Telegraph because they do have a number of Catholic journalists writing for it. In May, the former Bishop of London, Father Graham, as he's now called, Graham Leonard, who was well known for being at the cenotaph every year at the ceremony that they have on the 11th of November, he became a Catholic, having retired as Bishop of London. So it wasn't exactly as dramatic a conversion as if he had still been in office. Nonetheless, he has still quietly worked away, furthering the faith among a particular group. He hasn't taken a high-profile stand, but nonetheless, it was an extraordinary thing historically for a former bishop to become a Catholic, as have other former bishops in the Church of England retired. You then saw the wave of Anglican vicars who became Catholics in the wake of the vote for women priests, and one or two other members of what was then the Conservative cabinet, Anne Widdecombe and John Gummer, both became Catholics. And rather interestingly, in that same year, again, all this in the early months of 1993, the mother of the Princess of Wales became a Catholic. So these individual conversions did have a slight effect, I think. One can't talk about it spiritually, but in terms of the political nature of the Church, being a Catholic became slightly more acceptable than it was in the past. The Catholic Church is always... it's never going to be part of the world. It is set apart from the world. Nonetheless, in this country, it has traditionally, for centuries, been an anti-Catholic establishment. We have a church and a state which is established. We have a royal family who is not allowed to marry a Catholic if they wish to retain their right to the throne. So these are embedded in our laws, essentially. We are an anti-Catholic country.
Although that, of course, is likely to change with the European laws and so on. And we now have a Prime Minister who's married to a Catholic. Cherie Blair is a Catholic and so on. So I think that establishment Protestantism is giving way to a more muddled approach. I would have to share, I think, your perception that these conversions had a great value in that sense, but it isn't really like the 19th century in quite that way. And of course it is also worth pointing out that, sadly, isn't it right to say that we're leaking boys and girls from our Catholic schools, both into sort of, well, atheism and agnosticism, and less unhappily, because it's not quite as bad, but tragically, into some of these sort of born-again Bible churches, which is sort of all right for a time, but is often the next stage out of Christianity altogether. It's an emotional experience, and then when that fizzles out, it goes. And the statistics for Catholics in England and Wales tend to reflect that, don't they?
Oh, yes. No, there's a terrible crisis in the Church in terms of the number of people born into the faith who are just not keeping the faith going, who go to Catholic schools, who are not taught the faith at Catholic schools, as I was. My school was actually founded by an American, Cornelia Connolly, who was specifically asked by the Pope to set up a Catholic school for the children of people who would normally send their children away to convents in France and Belgium. And she did that very well. It was the Society of the Holy Child Jesus. If you look at that society now, it's entirely different from the one she founded. And so, sadly, one really is looking at a tragedy in terms of what the Catholic Church is achieving at the moment, and one just has to be very realistic about it.
So, looking through your book and pondering on the lives of the people that you read and then wrote about, Who is there that particularly spoke to you as a woman at the beginning of the 21st century? Is there any one character that made a special appeal to you?
Yes, I think, in fact, a surprising convert who I discovered was the Duke of Marlborough, who, in actual fact, became a Catholic right at the beginning of the 20th century, but I included in this book because his family stretched back into the later years of the 19th century. He had married Consuela Vanderbilt, the heiress, whose fortune was used to, really, repair Blenheim Palace. She was forced into the marriage. It was a clear case of an annulment being appropriate, and it was granted. However, in the annulment proceedings, which took 3 years, the Duke became so interested in Catholicism that he received instruction from the Jesuit Father Martindale, himself a convert, and he became a Catholic, was received into the church in Westminster Cathedral, and he died not long afterwards. He did, however, want to end his days as a lay brother in a Carmelite monastery in Spain, and led a very austere, holy life. And in fact, his cousin, Winston Churchill, Prime Minister during the Second World War, recalled his cousin at his cousin's funeral and said of him, "The need of contact with sublime and supernatural, of which he was profoundly conscious, led him to the Church of Rome. He asked for sanctuary within that august and seemingly indestructible communion, against which his ancestor had warred with formidable strength. The shelter and protections were accorded, and the last years of his life were lived in a religious calm which fortified him against the troubles of the world and the errors we all make in travelling through it."
You can't really improve on the magnificent prose of Sir Winston Churchill. Rounding off that interview with Madeline Beard, whose book, Faith and Fortune, is available from Morehouse Publishing, P.O. Box 1321, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania 17105. Telephone 800-877-0012. And it's $21, including postage.
We hope that you've enjoyed this look at some of our Catholic heritage. There'll be more next time, so we hope you'll join us then. If you have any comments or snippets of history or information, do write to me, Peter Johnson, at Catholic Heritage, EWTN Radio, 1500 High Road, Vandiver, that's Vandiver, Alabama, USA, 35176. Or you can email us at radio@ewtn.com.